Welcome to The Journey, a chronological study which goes through scripture from Genesis to Revelation in chronological order.
One of the main things that came out of a number of parables and stories and exhortations he gave was that your status here on earth doesn't have anything to do with your status in the kingdom of heaven. And he told that weird story, maybe parable, maybe not, about Lazarus and Abraham and the rich man, and talked a lot about that your status. And that's important because we didn't finish last week, and actually he's going to make that point again, so just so it'll make sense to you. The context of a lot of the stories he's been sharing was exactly that. You Pharisees are counting on your current status to carry over. You think that God will look at you differently and judge you differently, and make, you know, when he welcomes you, you'll have this kind of high position because of the things, because of the status you have on earth, because of your power, because of your money, because of the way people, your reputation. Those things just don't matter to God. And that's a lot of what Jesus has been saying. And it's been making the Pharisees very mad. I think of the last verse, if I remember correctly from last week, let me go back and look really quickly, was them plotting to kill him. It says the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that anyone who found out where Jesus was should report it so that they might arrest him. So that doesn't specifically say, or wait, is that the right one? No, that's not it. That's today.
The last thing was just he told them to forgive seven times.
You're right.
So, but a little bit before that, no, that didn't happen. Never mind.
No, I didn't. I'm actually remembering today it's going to happen. And it did happen, it has happened before now, obviously.
No.
Yes, it has. Okay, so here we are starting in verse 5. So it says, the apostles said to the Lord, increase our faith. Now, I think the reason that they said that and the reason for the review coming up to this just now is because he's been saying a lot of things. You know, your status won't get you there. Doing things here won't get you there. You need to forgive each other seven times. You need to really forgive each other. He's been saying some fairly hard things. And so I think they're like, wow, this is a lot. Help us, you know, God, increase our faith. We don't want to miss out. Increase our faith. And he replied, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it will obey you. And this is what's really important about this is that he's pointing out it's not the size of your faith. You know, a lot of times I think we get very concerned, and we even define faith in weird ways. A lot of times we define faith as willpower or certainty, and we think I just need to be more certain. I need to have no questions, or I just need to really think really hard about this. I just need to persuade myself to go all in on this. And that's not what faith is anyway. And he's pointing out that it's not the size. They're like, gosh, you're asking a lot from us. So you better make us people of whatever, better willpower, better certainty, better strength of mind or character, or whatever they're defining faith as. And in his answer, he's actually redefining what faith is a little bit for them, because he says, if your faith is tiny, if it's really, really small, it can still do really big things. So it isn't a matter of needing to increase your faith. And the implication, which he makes explicit in other passages, is that what's important is the object of your faith. It's your dependence upon Jesus. It's just that you recognize that he's in control. That's what it is. It's not your certainty about things happening. It's not your willpower to convince yourself of anything. It's not even your certainty, you know, the sort of the amount of your certainty that Jesus is, you know, is powerful. Jesus is powerful because he's powerful. He doesn't get less powerful or more powerful based upon your faith. And so he's just saying, look, whatever you've got, as long as it's directed at me, whatever you've got, as long as you're attaching it to me, as long as you're surrendering to me, as long as you're looking to me to do it, that's all you need. That will cause anything. That will get rid of all of your, you know, whatever is in your way, whether it's this mulberry tree or in another case, he says, this mountain. You know, whatever it is, all you need to do is recognize that it's my authority and it's my power that's doing it. And ironically, these verses sometimes are used to encourage people to have more faith. These verses are used to encourage people to think more about it as a power that they have, which is kind of completely opposite of what he's saying by emphasizing how small it can be. But that's a really good, I think it's a good encouragement for them at this point. They're like, wow, you're asking a lot from us, make us better. And he says, it's not about that. It's just, trust me. You know, if you're leaning on me, you're fine. If you're looking to me, you're fine. And then he goes on, he tells one more story. And this one more story is absolutely in the same tenor as all of last week, that he's trying to say to all those people who are counting on their power, their status, their reputation, who are looking at kind of the big shots that they are on earth. And he wants to say to them, you know, be aware that you're looking at this wrong. If you think you're entitled to something from God, you're wrong. And this is what he says. He says, suppose one of you has a servant plowing or looking after the sheep. Will he say to the servant when he comes in from the field, come along now and sit down to eat? Won't he rather say, prepare my supper, get yourself ready and wait on me while I eat and drink, and after that you may eat and drink? Will he thank the servant because he did what he was told to do? So you also, when you have done everything you were told to do, should say, we are unworthy servants. We have only done our duty. And of course, in a different context, this is not the same as when Jesus says things like, I'm your friend and you can come to me, you know, with confidence. And obviously, this is not a depiction of the way God sees us or his relationship that he desires to have with us. But it is a depiction of us recognizing, having the right perspective, recognizing who we really are. God is not obligated rather, to do anything. We are not entitled to God doing things for us because we tried so hard or because on earth people really thought we were hot stuff. That's the point he's making to them. You think you've been serving me so well that when you get to heaven, you're gonna have a really elevated status just because you've been serving me. Well, the truth is you should be serving me anyway. That doesn't earn you anything. That earns you no points. That's the minimum. And all those times you haven't been serving me, all those times you've been serving yourself, well, that goes against all of that. So again, he's not expressing the way God's relationship with us will be or is, but he's expressing that he's trying to shake them from their attitude of entitlement, their sense that, well, we are God's people. We are the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the priests, and we are those who work hard for God. And so we, of course, have better status. You know, the rich man who felt like he was entitled to have Lazarus comfort him and soothe his tongue, or even have Lazarus go take care of his family members and warn them of what was to come. You know, the message in that parable was, you're not entitled to any of that. Just because you're rich on earth and you thought you were entitled to it on earth and you didn't treat Lazarus well, that showed your true character. So I just think that's the point of this. It's pretty strong. But again, I think it's completely accurate, as long as we remember that it's not saying this is how God thinks of us as people, that he is going to welcome us as his children, as his inheritance. We're told that from the gospel. But the reality is he's God and we're not entitled to anything. He's not obligated to do anything. He chooses to give us everything. He chooses to give us all things, as Paul says later. So that's what that's about. Any thoughts on that? Or anything else you remember from last week? Any comments on this passage of Luke 17 before we move into sort of a new section in John 11? Yes, Meredith.
Okay, well, I could kind of see why people would think that they need to increase their faith more because, I mean, like, if someone has great dependence on God, you know, I couldn't say like be uprooted and plant in the sea. So it seems a little ambiguous. I don't know that part. I mean, I get that. Yeah, it has to be kind of like what God wants, but then, well, even you were talking about like, I don't know, you said something, oh, like that they're not entitled to anything or whatever. And I had a thought about that, but I forgot it.
Okay. Yeah, I think the faith thing, I think this is tricky. And I think it's something that stumbles a lot of us at times. And I think it is really important to sort of get out of the mindset that what God is waiting for us to believe harder or believe more. All he wants us to do is, I mean, the irony is believing more means believing less in our ability to do anything, to believe more, to make it work, to make that tree go in the sea. To make the tree go in the sea is less about believing we can do it or the tree can do it, but it's about believing God can do it. And so believing more is all necessarily about just surrendering and trusting God. And so in a sense, yes, you can talk about, well, I trust God or I don't trust God. You can talk about, I think God could make this mulberry tree go, but I'm not sure. But the point is, even there, he would say, yeah, but is it him that you're thinking can do it at all? Or are you thinking that it's your strength of faith? It's how strongly you believe that's going to make it happen. And I think the conundrum between saying, well, if I believe strongly enough, these things will happen. And Jesus saying, no, I don't want you going there because that makes it about you. It's about me. Your faith could be tiny. And if it's me, I'm doing the power. So I think it is. It's one of those things we have to wrestle with a little bit to see how that plays out actually in our lives. But I think it's a really important thing because it really does come down to saying, am I seeing faith as a work, as an act that I need to do and do better and do well? Or am I just understanding that faith is just saying, it's really up to you, Lord, and kind of be more and more of that attitude. And it is a little bit hard to describe surrender as something you need more of. You can, and he even says to the apostles at one point, oh, you have little faith. So there's a context in which it's appropriate to speak that way. But I think for most of us, we tend to really be merging faith into ideas of willpower or certainty or trying harder. And I think Jesus in this point is trying to say, yeah, don't worry about it. It's not about you.
I mean, I guess the Pharisees were kind of doing that in a sense because it was kind of about what they did and their heritage, and it really wasn't in Jesus anyway.
Yeah, 100%. You know, you could see the apostles' question as even being in relation to the Pharisees, like, wow, he's really getting on them, and they seem to have a lot of faith because they're really, you know, their whole life is about this. And so he's saying, yeah, don't be fooled by that. That's not what it's about. So it fits in with everything else about entitlement, and same thing here. Well, you try really hard, you sort of believe really hard. That doesn't entitle you either. It's about Jesus. It's about surrendering to him. It's about depending on him, which I think the Pharisees were not doing. I think you're right. Anybody else have any thoughts or questions on that?
I think that other last little story that he tells is also really consistent with how frequently he has to tell them to just worry a lot less about credit with God, but also with people. The idea that, you know, serve people because you should, not because you're going to get the seat at the table, or you don't get to decide who sits on the right and the left. And so this is a little more specific, but it's still part of that message that he's trying to impress upon them, that you don't get power the way everyone else thinks you get power, by earning credit, by making sure people recognize what you're doing.
Yeah, that's really good. That's really good. Any other thoughts?
I have a question, David.
Yeah.
The thing about the mulberry tree, can I take that to mean that no one has ever had the faith of a mustard seed? Because I don't think, unless if I missed it on ESPN, I don't think there are any mulberry tree into the sea contest going on. So does that mean that no one has faith of a mustard seed?
No, I think it just means that God has never desired to throw a mulberry tree into the sea. So he hasn't asked anybody to believe him to do that. I mean, we've certainly seen people have faith and God did other things, like Elijah, were caused it to rain. And I think he would say the same thing about that. So I think it's just an example. It's just kind of it was something handy. Like he says a mountain at another time. Why does he say a mulberry tree now? Because it's right here. And he's like, this looks like a big thing, but you could uproot it and throw it in the sea. So I don't think it means that no one has the faith the size of a mustard seed. I think it just means that wasn't the act of faith God was looking for to happen. So it just hasn't been there. But I think people have, I think we all do. I think, if you have salvation, you received it with faith size of a mustard seed. That's probably pretty accurate. Most of us didn't believe very much at all, but we just leaned upon Jesus, and he moved, in a sense, a metaphorical mulberry tree when he moved us from death to life. Much, much bigger miracle than throwing a mulberry tree into the sea. And that's another thing I think is important. We often talk about big dramatic faith miracles, and when we hear about them, we think about, you know, how much faith is involved in them. But I think often the big dramatic things are so small. You know, when you think about, you know, what we see someone do, if someone could uproot the tree and throw it in the sea, who does that change? 100 years later, no one cares that mulberry tree was thrown in the sea. So I think that's part of it too. I think God is like, that seems like a big thing to you guys, but we're going to do much bigger things. We're going to change people's salvations and lives and hearts. And so that's what I think. That's how I see it. Does that make sense, Bill?
Yes, thank you.
Sure. Yes, Mary.
Yeah, well, I was kind of thinking a little bit on the same lines as Bill. That's why I kind of asked that in the first place. And I guess too, I mean, he's, like you're saying, it's what was there, is what was available. And he's not like giving like a how-to, like, on salvation or something, he's making this, like a lot of other times, you know, it's kind of like, well, you know, because we're like really getting into it or whatever, but he's like making a point about how it's, yeah, like not how it's about dependence, like on him and not the size of your faith and not in yourself. And then I also like what you said about the, like the big things maybe not being the big things and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think ultimately it's an encouragement to them. And to tie it a little bit to what Lorraine said too, I think that it's an encouragement because he's saying you don't have to, you don't, the Pharisees think that they're earning it all and you don't have to. You don't worry about that. Stop worrying about that. You know, I'm getting on the Pharisees here precisely because they don't understand that it's about me. Don't you start worrying about that and trying to be like them. So you're worried you don't have enough faith. Well, relax, because even if you only had a tiny, tiny bit of faith, we'd be in, you'd be with me. That'd be it. So I think ultimately it's an encouragement.
Well, Laura may have already said this, but it does kind of break down a little bit of the caste system too and make Jesus more available, because it's like you don't have to have all these things that make it like look like faith or whatever.
Yeah, one of the problems, I think there are a couple of identifiable significant issues, but one of the problems with you know, name it and claim it and some forms of faith healing is that what they always end up doing is becoming a status symbol, that you have enough faith to make yourself rich, you have enough faith to be healed, you have enough faith for this or that. And it does, it becomes a thing of, ooh, look how spiritual they are, look how righteous they are. And I think that that's, again, right in there, the same caste system that Jesus is actually trying to disrupt, to where we shouldn't even be making those judgments, you know, because we don't know what's going on in the hearts of people and their ability to make amazing things happen is nothing in a sense to Jesus. So good. All right. Well, let's go on to John chapter 11. This is I'll just remind you, I won't comment probably on it. Whoops. I won't comment probably on this part of it again, necessarily. But remember that we had that story of Lazarus and the rich man and Abraham last week. And we talked about the fact that one reason possibly that Jesus uses the name that actually gives a name to someone in the parable, which is unusual, that one reason he uses the name Lazarus, if it is a parable, if it's not a true story, which could be, but if it is a parable, one reason he might use the name Lazarus is so that when what's about to happen in John chapter 11 happens, it will remind people of that story, because he told the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, and then he concludes it by saying, even if someone raised from the dead, you would not be persuaded of who Jesus was. And clearly the Lazarus in that story is not the Lazarus in the story that we're about to read, because they're just not the same people. One serves a rich man, one doesn't. But the fact that he used the same name might be to remind them, so that when he does raise Lazarus from the dead, and spoiler alert, if you don't know where the story goes, that's what's going to happen. When he does raise Lazarus from the dead, people might remember the story and say, oh, wow, this is that we should pay attention to this. We should believe, because I remember him saying, even if this happened, a lot of us wouldn't believe. Well, I don't want to be one of those guys. This is amazing what I've seen. And it is true. We'll see that when he does raise Lazarus, it immediately causes a greater schism. All these chapters so far recently have been about a schism, people believing more or turning away completely. And that kind of happens at the end of this. You have some people who really aggressively reach for Jesus, and you have some people who now aggressively reach for Jesus to strangle him, so to speak. So let's go ahead and read, see how it unfolds. There's a lot of interesting things about this story. It's a great story. It's the reason we remember it. One of the things before we jump into it that I'll remind you of is that John, so I mentioned this a couple times, but it's been a while, so you can easily be forgiven if you don't recall this. John uses the number 7 in 3 different ways throughout his Gospels. The first one is he has Jesus say 7 times, I am something. I am the door, he said at one point. I am the way. He's going to say coming up, I am the resurrection. So 7 different times he says, I am. John also has him engage in 7 different conversations. So there's Nicodemus, there's the woman at the well. He has 7 of those, 7 what are called discourses. And so we have these points of 7. Well, the other thing that John does that there's 7 of is 7 signs. And it's interesting because Jesus clearly did more miracles than 7. But John selects 7 of those signs and specifically mentions them. Each time he talks about a miracle of Jesus, he says, this was the first sign, or this was the second sign, so on and so forth. This sign with Lazarus is the 7th. It's the last one. It's sort of the ultimate. And so the question is, why is John, he obviously Jesus said lots of things. Why is he picking seven of them? You know, obviously Jesus did lots of miracles. Why is he picking seven of them? Jesus had a ton of conversations. Why is he picking seven of them? And the reason that John is doing that is to make a really significant point. First of all, he's trying to do things that none of the other gospel writers have done yet, because he's writing after them and he knows what's sort of not been done. But I think the other thing is, he knows that for the Hebrews, and John writes to both Greeks and Hebrews, he knows for the Hebrews that seven is a number of completion. This is what they understand the number seven to mean. It means perfection. It means completion. There's a proverb, literal proverb from Solomon, which says, a wise man falls seven times, a righteous man falls seven times and gets back up. And the point of that is not just literally seven times, but completely. Remember how Jesus said, you must forgive someone not only seven times, but 70 times seven. Again, the idea is more than completely. Be completely ridiculous about how often you forgive people. So this idea of seven has this idea of completeness. So by John having him do seven signs and seven I ams, he's showing that Jesus is everything that we need him to be. He is absolutely the Messiah, and there's no question about it. And in fact, he's God. He's so completely all we need because he's God. So these seven signs, I think for John, mean they're not just seven signs of his messianic nature, although they are that. I think for John, they're also seven signs of his divinity. They ultimately show that Jesus is God. And to wrap up, to sort of be the ultimate sign, and he doesn't call Jesus' own resurrection a sign because it's in a category all its own, although Jesus called it a sign in one sense, but to raise Lazarus, aside from Jesus' own resurrection, to raise Lazarus is sort of the ultimate sign. Here we have him bringing someone back to life, taking someone from death to life. It is the epitome of what the Messiah is here to do, and it is also something that only God himself could do. And so that's what's going on here. In case you're curious, the seven signs in John were turning water into wine, healing the official's son, the official who came to him, and then Jesus healed him before the official even got home, healing the man at the pool who couldn't get into the pool because he was crippled, feeding of the 5,000, walking on water, healing a man born blind, and then this one resurrecting Lazarus. So these are, they kind of ramp up. You know, we start with turning water into wine and we end with raising a man from the dead. There's a definite sort of progressive sense in the way that John portrays it. All right, so now here's the story as John tells it. Now, a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sister sent word to Jesus, Lord, the one you love is sick. I'm not going to go into details about this. There's an interesting theory out there, which is not really persuasive to me, but it's fascinating. But there's an interesting theory out there that the book of John, it was not written by John, but it's written by Lazarus. Remember that the book of John, the author never says who he is, and he just calls himself the one whom Jesus loves. And here it says, the sister sent word to Jesus, Lord, the one you love, the one you love is sick. And there is this theory that the reason the author of Book of John, which I guess if they're right, should be called Lazarus, but the reason the author is so devoted to Jesus and recognizes he's loved is because he actually was raised from the dead. I'm not persuaded by that, because for that to be true, you have to somehow come up with an explanation of why John the Apostle doesn't exist in this book at all. So I just present it because it's interesting and it's a theory out there that some people have. Nonetheless, the one you love is sick. When he heard this, Jesus said, this sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's son may be glorified through it. Okay, I have read this story so many times. And as often happens with scripture, I noticed something this last time I read it, or I had a thought about something. It doesn't say this for sure, and so I can't guarantee this, but I had a thought the last time I read this I've never had before, and it changes a little bit of the dynamic of what moves forward, and it's this. Jesus, we're told right here, Jesus gets this message that says, Lord, the one you love is sick, and he gets it from Mary and Martha, so he knows who they're talking about. Right after that, it says, when he heard this, Jesus said, the sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's son may be glorified through it. And I've always just had the picture of he got the message, he turned to his apostles, and he said, it's not going to end in death. And something occurred to me today that it is just as reasonable to read this as his reply to their message. In other words, he's not just saying it to the apostles. This might be the message he's sending back to Mary and Martha, which puts a little bit different tenor on things, because it means that he sent them a comforting message. But here's the irony of the comforting message he sent. As Jeff helped us work out a few cycles ago in this, by the time that Jesus hears that Lazarus has died, at least for sure by the time that they would get this return message, Lazarus has already died. I mean, by the time he hears he's sick, Lazarus has already died. It happens way before Jesus has a chance to get back. And what's interesting is there's a lot of complication in the idea that Mary and Martha receive this message from Jesus that says, this will not end in death, and they're looking at the dead body of Lazarus while they're reading it. It adds so many emotions and complications and confusions. And I don't know for sure that that's what's happening here, that he's sending a message back to them. But it just occurred to me that he could be. And it makes perfect sense that's what he would do. He heard this message, and this is what he said in reply. And it would make a lot of sense if that's what's going on. So I'm going to kind of go with that possibility as we go forward. It doesn't change any of the theology, obviously, but it affects the interactions that happen just a little bit to know that they've already heard this promise from Jesus that looks like it's failed. They got this message that looks kind of iffy, and they're already processing how to respond to it. And I think one way you respond to it is you think, well, he said it won't end in death. Well, Lazarus is clearly dead, so probably he's talking about some future resurrection. He's probably talking about the time when we're all going to be resurrected, you know, to face judgment, which they did believe in. Many Jews did. Not all did. Many did. Pharisees did. Sadducees did not. So it's possible they're already sort of wrestling with what a weird message Jesus sent. I know he was trying to comfort us, but the practical reality of it has already failed us. Now we can see that his message is carefully crafted, even to say it will not end in death. He doesn't say he won't die. He says it won't end in death. It's going to end in him being resurrected again. And so that's possible. Okay. So that's just one thing stuck out to me, that maybe this is a message he sent back. Goes on, says, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. This is just a reminder to me for people who say, oh, Lazarus is the one who wrote the book of John because it says Jesus loved him. This verse here reminds us Jesus loved a lot of people. And so that in itself is not a good proof that Lazarus wrote this book. There's other reasons they say that, but nonetheless, it's fascinating. It's important to see that. It says here, he loved Martha, he loved sister, he loved Lazarus. I like just that statement. And I think it's intended to be read not just as a generic God loves everybody, but as they were friends. They had this, he loved them, and they knew he loved them. But then it says this. It says, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So, this word so is like because, right? So it says, he loved them, so when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. Now, I'm going to give you another way to read this in a second. There's 2 possible ways to understand this, but it's peculiar just going that far to read that it says, because he loved Martha and Lazarus and his sister, he decided to stay for 2 more days. So it says, when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. And then he said to his disciples, let's go back to Judea. So if in fact Lazarus is already dead, which he probably is by the time he heard from them, and he's definitely dead now, his delay of 2 days, as Jeff has reminded me in the past, isn't what caused Jesus to miss Lazarus. In other words, even if Jesus had left at the moment he got the message, Lazarus would already have been dead. So the question is, why is he delaying 2 days? It's weird. One possible way to read it is it says, because he loved them, he delayed 2 days. Now, my grammar daughter might be seeing another way to read this, which I'll get to in a second. But one way to read it is that it's saying he delayed because he loved them. And then you have to ask the question, how is that loving them? Because his delay, even though it didn't cause him to miss Lazarus, it's got a rankle, right? They aren't going to care. When he comes, if he said to them, look, I knew Lazarus was already dead, so I figured I'd wait a couple more days, that doesn't make them feel any more loved and prioritized. You know, if he had shown up as soon as he possibly could after Lazarus had died, that would have made them feel a little bit better. But here he is, he delays. So how is that not cruel? How is that not sort of just making them wait more? How is that loving him? And I think one possible way to see it, and if it's not what's happening here, it is nonetheless a good lesson for us, because I think it is true, so I'm going to share it anyway, is that he knows what's going to happen, right? He knows that Lazarus is going to come to life. He knows that he's going to bring him back and everything will be okay. He knows that ultimately what Mary and Martha are going to experience is an incredible joy. What they're going to experience is a joy greater maybe than they've ever experienced, because it's one thing to have somebody saved from death. It's another thing to have someone die and brought back to life. That gives you hope for everything, because it means the very worst that could happen happened, and then Jesus fixed it. And so one thing it means is that he knows that's coming. They don't know that. So in the meantime, it feels like a cruelty for him to not be there. But for him, he wants them to have this greater joy, and he wants them at the same time to see his power. He wants them to know it's him. If he were able to come home and rescue Lazarus before he had died, that's good. That's great. But there's always that, well, he got better, right? That happens. People get better. But to actually raise him from the dead, it gives them a greater picture of God's glory. It increases their faith, so to speak, to go to with what the apostles are asking for. So in one sense, I think when it says, because he loves them, he delayed 2 days, I think it could mean he sees what they don't see. What looks to them cruel, what looks to them just like to cause them pain, is actually really loving, because he's making sure that they get the maximum bang for their buck. Again, Lazarus is already dead. But he's making sure that they're going to get the best response. They're going to get the most sense of joy and the greatest sense of God's glory. They are going to, from the changes to their life forever are set in stone. And you can argue that. This is a turning point for Mary and Martha and Lazarus. They never see Jesus the same way after this. Would you? Of course not. So that's what it could mean. And I think that's an important lesson, because I think there are certainly times in our lives where God seems absent or he seems to delay. We're like, God, you could have just done this differently. You could have just done this at this time and in this way. There's so many times that it feels that way. And to take hope in the thought that God sees things we don't see, and he knows what's coming, and that he may be delaying, and he may be doing these things. And although there's no way to see them as positive right now for us, to recognize that God is doing them to bring us greater joy and greater faith and greater glory and a greater sense of his glory, I think it's comforting to me anyway. It gives me hope. It reminds me that I can't always understand God, but that doesn't mean that what God is doing is cruel just because it may appear to be. And then in fact, it could in fact be loving. And I want to remind you, in this context, there's nothing about it that looks loving. We know what's coming, but he's letting them stew in their grief over their dead brother. And that is impossible. If someone said to them at that moment, hey, God is doing this because he loves you, that would have been befuddling to them. So that's one possibility, that it says he delayed 2 days because he loved them. Of course, the other way to read it may be simpler. And that's that it's not saying he delayed 2 days because he loved them. It's saying parenthetically, he delayed 2 days, but because he loved them, he said to his disciples, let's go back. Because the other truth is he doesn't have to go back. Even to raise Lazarus from the dead, he doesn't have to go back. We know that. He can do his miracle from afar. He's done all sorts of miracles from afar. He could send them that message, which says this will not end in death. And then a couple of days later, he could raise Lazarus from the dead without going back. And as we're going to see, there's a reason not to go back. So it could just be saying to us, why is he going back? Because he wants to be with them. Because he wants to be there when they experience their joy. Because he wants to be there with them in their grief. And he wants to be there with them in their joy. He just wants to be part of it. He could do it from afar, but he wants to be with them. Either way, and that again would explain why it says, because he loved them, he said, let's go to them. Not because he needed to heal Lazarus, but because he loved them. He just wanted to be with them. Whichever way you read this, the point is valid. He loved them, and what he's about to do, and the fact that he's going back to them when he does, is because he loves them. He wants to be there for them and with them, both in their grief and in their joy. And so we're getting this really clear, beautiful picture of his relationship with them, but it's also very complex, because he's making them wait because they said come back, and he didn't come back right away. He says, let's go back to Judea. And the apostles' answer is this: but Rabbi, they said, a short while ago the Jews there tried to stone you, and yet you were going back. Now think again, if he did send a message back, the apostles' response makes even more sense. If they heard him send a message back saying this will not end in death, they may not yet know that Lazarus is dead. And if they hear him, that he sent a message saying it wouldn't end in death, and now he says, well, let's go back, it's even more reasonable for them to say, why are we going back? You said he'd be fine, and that's dangerous, because they want to kill you, and they want to kill us. I think the next sentence from Jesus is a little bit perplexing, but it makes more sense, I think, if we understand that they're worried about themselves, probably at least as much, and in reality, probably more, that they're worried about Jesus right now. Going back to Judea is dangerous. People are not happy with Jesus. there's some people who are not happy with Jesus and therefore not happy with his closest followers. So they say, a short while ago, the Jews tried to stone you, and yet you're going back. And Jesus answered, sort of obliquely, are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble, for they see by this world's light. It is when a person walks at night that they stumble, for they have no light. Okay, before I give you my thoughts on this sentence, any comments, any thoughts on anything we've read so far, and any comments on what you think Jesus is saying here about the daylight and the walking and the stumbling?
Well, something that really stood out to me that I thought of while we're discussing this is that it kind of reminds me of the verse from Genesis where Joseph forgives his brothers, and Joseph tells his brothers that what they meant for evil, God can use for good. And of course, in this regard, Lazarus' sickness or death wasn't necessarily meant for evil, but it's still another example of God can take, hard to understand crummy situations and make something good out of them.
Yeah, and the hardest to understand, most crummy, right? I mean, this is kind of the epitome of what makes life meaningless and what makes things difficult for us is that it ends in death. And so, yeah, this is like the hardest of them. Yep. Other thoughts?
Well, I do like that it says about how, like, he loved, them. And especially since his actions seem to possibly contradict that. And then also, making the point too, like, that Jesus, yeah, there is a big picture, bigger picture, like you were saying, because he really does care and, like, want to be with them. So there must be some reason why he, would wait for that, I think. And then I was also kind of thinking about the daylight, and I don't know if this is right, because this has always seemed kind of weird to me. But I was kind of thinking about how like Jesus is like the light and like following God and stuff. And so maybe like in that sense, they're, going in the daylight or whatever and like following him.
That's exactly, and I'll kind of flesh that out a little bit for my end. That's exactly what I think. I think you're spot on, Meredith. Anybody else, though, have any thoughts about what Jesus is doing? Because it is weird. It's a strange response to them. It must have been a little bit frustrating and perplexing to them, to be perfectly honest. But any other?
Well, it's a little bit strange, too, because it's like the examples he gives are like, almost seem like a little contradictory, because like physically you would think they would evade capture more if they were going in the night than like in the day, like everyone would see him. So it kind of seems like the example's kind of part of it, but it doesn't necessarily have to be.
Yeah, if he's talking just practically about how to avoid being captured, then it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. I agree. any other thoughts? Anybody have any ideas on what Jesus is talking about here?
I have one.
Yeah.
I find it interesting, that 2 days longer, could this be foreshadowing his own death and his resurrection on the third day and letting people see, when he dies, he's done this once, he'll do it again. And maybe that gives them hope. And that's where, the love comes in. He's trying to show what's going to happen in the future.
I think you're right in principle, for sure. It turns out when he raises Lazarus, Lazarus will actually have been in the grave 4 days. So it doesn't completely line up. But if nothing else, it could be like, hey, I've done it harder, right? last guy I raised was already 4 days in the grave. So it's not exactly a parallel to what happens to Jesus. But yes, absolutely. And there's no question, even when he talks to Mary and Martha, that's part of what he says to them, is he's trying to help them see that there's a bigger principle here that he wants them to understand about who he is. So I think, yes, for sure, he's giving them hope by what he does with Lazarus. And it's very much pointing to him and what's going to happen with him later. And there's no question Mary and Martha remember that. I mean, it seems to me there would be no question that Mary and Martha remember that when Jesus does come back to life, which may be why they're two of the earliest to believe it, right? That the the resurrection and the responses from all of the apostles is one of differing abilities to believe what's happened. And I'll be honest, I would be on the skeptical end of this thing. If I didn't see Jesus myself, I would definitely be like Thomas almost more than anything else. But there's differing sort of ways that people respond. It's interesting that Mary and Martha are one of the first to believe, and maybe because what they've seen with Lazarus, it would make sense.
I like that. So are all, like, when it talks about Mary's, except for, is it just like Mary's mother and then Mary of Mary and Martha?
No, then there's Mary Magdalene too.
And Mary Magdalene.
Yeah.
For some reason, I thought before Mary Magdalene was the one that wept at Jesus' feet. But I know it says that it's this Mary, but
they both do. There's an
event. Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's one of those confusing things, and there's an earlier story, and even the chronology shows you they're different stories. Now, some people make the theory they're the same story, and the authors got confused about which Mary it was, but I'm inclined not to think that kind of confusion typically happens in the scripture because of God's preservation. So if you take it the way it is, there's an earlier story chronologically, which is Mary Magdalene, and a later story, which is Mary and Martha that weep at his feet. So they both do it. And it's not, to me, impossible that would happen. I think that's sort of a normal act of adoration in that culture at that time. So I think that,
even
a feminine one, I think it makes some sense. It's just so intimate, it makes people uncomfortable, which is understandable.
Is Mary Magdalene the woman he cast 7 demons out of, or is that just what some people think? We know that.
So the Marys get a little tricky.
Sorry, I took us on a rabbit trail.
No, again. It's okay. And there's also been a lot of assumptions made about the Marys. And so that gets a little tricky. So I'm going to tell you what I think I recall, Lorian, but it's possible. Now I'm going to have to go back and look, because now I'm like, well, maybe I'm misremembering. I am pretty sure that Mary Magdalene is, in fact, the one that 7 demons were cast out of. What is traditionally been thought, but there's actually no evidence for it, is that Mary Magdalene was also a prostitute. It doesn't actually tell us that. And so now people are starting to rethink that and saying, maybe that was just, whatever, male ego or something. And she doesn't necessarily. She could be. I don't know that that's a problem either, because, again, it's part of what Jesus did. But I'm going to have to go back and look now, because maybe the Mary that had the 7 demons cast out was not Mary Magdalene, and maybe I've had confused a couple Marys.
I think it is Mary Magdalene.
I think it is too. That's my thought, but I'm just leaving myself room for this being another Paul on his horse moment. But I'm pretty sure.
Was it at the catacombs or one of the art museums where our tour guide did say that Mary Magdalene was a prostitute? I just looked at you upside deeply.
It was
actually, I wasn't going to pick a fight with a tour guide.
It was in the Vatican. And if you want to give her the benefit, sorry, I got Vatican and benefit confused. If you want to give her the benefit of doubt, she might have been saying in this painting, she's a prostitute, because certainly the Renaissance painters often presented her that way. But I'm actually with you. I think she just said she was.
I'm looking at, I Googled this. I don't know this. Luke 8:2.
Yeah.
And also some women who had been cured of evil spirits and diseases. Mary called Magdalene, for whom 7 demons had come out.
Okay. So I thank you for vindicating me.
How are we supposed to speculate wildly?
Yeah. Okay, good. So yeah, there are a lot of Marys, and sometimes they don't tell you which one you're talking about, by the way, too. So it's useful that Mary comes with Martha. That helps. And sometimes they say Mary the mother of Jesus, and sometimes they say Mary Magdalene, but sometimes they just say Mary, and then you don't really know which one you're dealing with for sure. So all right, well, here's what I think about the 12 hours comment. I think you all hit on pieces of what I'm going to say for sure. I see two possibilities, which both come mostly to the same thing. One possibility is that he's saying, look, you're worried about going to Judea because you're worried you're going to get killed. You're thinking it's unsafe there. Well, don't you recognize there's a difference between safe and unsafe in the world? And he specifically specifies the world because I think he's making a metaphor, an analogy. He says, in the world, when you want to walk safely, you walk in the light. And when you walk in the light, you're safe. You could walk in the same place in the dark and you'd stumble. So the issue is not where you are. The issue is whether you're in the light or not. And then you take Meredith's point that Jesus is the light. And what he's saying to them is, look, you'll be safer with me in Judea than you would be without me anywhere else. I am the light that keeps you safe. And I'm telling you right now, we'll be just fine. We'll go back and everything will be okay. The other possible thing he's saying, which comes to the same conclusion, which is that you're safer with me right now than you would be anywhere else. The other possibility of what he's saying is that we only have, metaphorically, 12 more hours of daylight. My death is coming up soon. My end is coming, but we're not there yet. So because we're not there yet, you're still safe with me, right? There will come a day where they will kill me, and then you may not be so safe with me. But right now, we're still in the daylight. So don't stop following me now, even though I'm going to go somewhere you don't like, because right now it's still safe. Either way, the bottom line is, stick with me, guys. I'm going back to Judea. Do you really want to be anywhere else? Even though we're going into the enemy's grounds, even though we're going into the hornet's nest, trust me that you want to be with me and not somewhere else. And so I do think that's the bottom line, regardless of kind of how he's getting there. And what's interesting is he doesn't even give them a chance to respond to it. We're going to see that in a second. He just says that, and then he goes right on to normal conversation. So it's like he just wants them to ponder it a little bit, but he's not really asking them. It's not one of those moments where he says something and then pauses to see if they understand. I think he's kind of like, they'll kind of get it later. Yeah, Meredith, were you going to say something?
Well, I think it's interesting that it says the world's light, because usually the world means like, usually the world doesn't have light as he talks about the world.
Well, and that's why I think he's just using this. This is not he's just using the what you do normal and as an example. He's just saying, look, in the world, you walk in the light, you're safe. And you walk in the dark, you stumble. Now, spiritually with me, you walk with me, you'll be safe. You walk without me, you won't be safe. So I don't think he's comparing. I don't think he's saying the world's light is good to a spiritual sense, but he's saying in the world sense it is. That's what keeps you safe. And I am the corollary to that.
Yeah, I guess that would definitely make the contrast more clear in that you're safe with me.
Right, right. Okay. But then, like I said, he says that. And then it says, after he'd said this, he went on to tell them. It's like he immediately goes on to something else. He just says that sort of mysteriously. And then it says, after he'd said this, he went on to tell them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I am going there to wake him up. Now, again, if he sent the message back saying this would not end in death, or even if he just said that to them, they have no reason to believe Lazarus is dead. So it's easy to pick on them right now for being stupid. But the truth is, they have no reason to believe Lazarus is dead. So when Jesus says, Lazarus is asleep, I'm going to wake him up, it's a weird thing for him to say, like, we're going to travel all the way to Judea so that I can be his alarm clock. That's peculiar. But given the fact they don't want to go back, it's also not a very good argument. They're like, well, why do we need to do that? And in fact, that's what they say. His disciples replied, Lord, if he sleeps, he will get better. They're like, Jesus, let us teach you a little bit about medicine. If he sleeps, he will get better. Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. So then he told them plainly. I love this moment too. It's kind of like Jesus is like, oh, sometimes I'm mysterious when I don't even mean to be. He's like, no, look, Lazarus is dead. Okay, just listen to me. Lazarus is dead. And for your sake, I am glad I was not there so that you may believe. So this goes back to the same thing we talked about, possibly that he's delaying and he's going back and he loves the sisters and he's really excited about what they're going to gain from this. Well, the same is true of the apostles. He says, I'm glad that I was not there. Not that he could have been there just from the message, but in theory, he could have been there anyway, right? He could have just chosen to be there before when Lazarus got sick. And his point is, I'm glad I wasn't there, because you are about to see something amazing. It's really true. And I really, in all these sort of the way he's thinking about Mary and Martha, the way he's thinking about his apostles, I really get this glint in the eye moment of like a father who's got this really cool surprise for his kids. And they're like grumpy, or they're not. Why did you, you know, we used to do pajama runs in our house, and I never quite did it this way, but what we did do is everybody would get in bed And after we put them down to bed, I would run through the house and I'd say, pajama run. And we'd all load up in the car and we'd go get ice cream. And it was just kind of fun because going to bed's a drag when you're a kid. And it was like this nice surprise. And so we do that. What I never did do, and this is a poor example, but it gives me a little bit of it, I guess. I never went through and said, okay, everybody get up. We have to go get in the car. I never sort of didn't tell them what was coming. But I could see how there could be kind of an excitement in, oh, they don't know what's going on. Why are we going here? Why are we doing this? And then suddenly they discover, oh, we're at Disneyland, or, oh, we got ice cream, or, you know, whatever. So I think there's some of that with Jesus here. He's like, you guys are going to see something so cool. It's going to blow your mind. In all your time with me, this is going to be the most impressive. Because even though some of them have heard of resurrections, and I think they've seen one or two, I'm trying to remember, Peter's mother-in-law or something. But even so, I think this is a significant one. Lazarus is a significant figure. He's been dead for 4 days. He's already in the grave. They haven't seen this yet. This is new. And so I think that he's just kind of excited about what they're going to get. He says, so let us go.
Like, not to argue or anything, but they did see, like, that one, like, the son of the widow was dead, and he brought him back to life.
Right. He raised a couple people back to life, but nobody's been in the grave.
Is whatever.
Right. Yeah. They've seen a couple of resurrections. So then it says, let us go to him. Let us go to him. It says, look, he's dead, but let us go. Right. And I'm glad. But he doesn't really tell him why. He's just like, let us go. And so he's determined to go back to Judea. And the apostles are like, we really don't want to go back because they're trying to kill us. And what is the plan? And then we have this moment. Then Thomas, also known as Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, let us go also, that we may die with him. I would only take a moment here to say, if all you know about Thomas Didymus, or Thomas the twin, which is what Didymus means, if all you know about Thomas the twin is that he doubted when Jesus came back to life, you're giving him a bad rap, because Thomas was willing to die, and he was the first one to say it. He was like, you know what? If Jesus says going with him is where we need to be, then I'm going to go with him, and if we die, we die. I'd rather go with him and die than have him go without us and die. So I'm with him. So Thomas is not a man of weak faith. He's just a skeptic who didn't have the opportunity to see Jesus in person the way the other apostles did. And here we see that he's got a significant faith and a real loyalty. And so I just want to, you know, stick up for the poor doubting Thomas here for a moment. All right. Well, on his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. So he not only died, now he's in the tomb. There's really a lot of questions here about how long Lazarus has been dead, because there's a whole grieving process. And sometimes it's 7 days before you put him in the tomb. I don't think that's what's happened here, because that just seems far too long for him having been gone and them sending a message. And it just feels like they wouldn't have even sent the message, because he would have already been dead before they sent the message. Something about that doesn't jive. So I don't think they've done the typical 7 days. So maybe it's because, who knows why. But Lazarus is, but what we do know is he's been in the tomb for 4 days. It says, now Bethany was less than two miles. Yes, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, they didn't mourn Jesus for 7 days before putting him in the tomb.
No, but that's because they were concerned about what the Romans were going to do and about the Sabbath. They were afraid that if they didn't get him down and in a tomb before the Sabbath, that something would happen to his body. So yeah, you're right. But that's why they went back after the Sabbath with spices, because they were going to get him out of the tomb and do some of the things they do, or do it in the tomb. But either way, they were going to do things that they normally would have done before he went in the tomb. That does go to the point that there could be reasons that Lazarus would have gone in the tomb earlier. By the way, one of those could have been that he had some sort of what we know as a communicable disease, what they know of as a disease that makes you unclean, and they don't want him hanging around the house. So that's also possible. Maybe he had leprosy or something. Who knows? On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem. This is the apostles' concern. They're like, Jerusalem is the hotspot of people looking for you to kill you. So they're very close now. So now Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. So they are doing the normal sort of grieving thing, even though he's in the tomb. They are having this, again, they do a lot of visitors and visitations, and kind of like we do during grieving. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. All right. as we talk through this, I just try to understand where people are at so the story resonates with reality. I will acknowledge that I do not know Mary and Martha's feelings throughout the rest of the story, except what they explicitly say. And so some of it is speculative. So please take the speculation as a way to maybe help us get a fuller picture of the story, but understand, I don't know what's actually happening here. For example, I don't know why Mary stayed at home. It says that Martha came out right away, but Mary stayed at home. I don't know why that is, but I find it fascinating that the Mary, who was so devoted to Jesus, to sit at his feet, wanted to be with him all the time, is now the Mary who doesn't want to come see him when he comes. No
worries. I have a thought.
Yeah.
I also wonder, I know that in certain cultures that funeral or a memorial is really a big deal, where the relatives of the person has died is expected to cook for and host all of the people who have come to mourn. And so I don't know if that's the case. I suspect perhaps in that time even that this was a big affair where her responsibility isn't just mourning him, but to take care of all those people who have come to mourn him. And so, and this is her brother who, as the sister, as the family member, as the person, as the remaining family, she's responsible for it could be a large affair that she's responsible for taking care of for Lazarus and for all the people who have come to mourn him. I mean, I'm just thinking about when our son in Africa, their baby died at birth, and they were expected to bury him within like 6 hours, but he and his wife were expected to host and feed and house all the people who came to see them for the memorial service. So I just wondered if it was something similar to that.
No, I suspect it is.
Well, I think that's interesting too, though, because in our first interaction with them, it seems that Martha is responsible for running and like the executor of the household. In fact, that's what gets Mary in trouble, sort of, is Martha's like, you're not doing enough hospitality. So I think it is. I think in some ways, there is so much that both Mary and Martha would be doing. You're totally right, Mom. And so the fact that Martha comes out to Jesus emphasizes their other interaction, which is that she has a relationship where she is going to bring an issue, a conflict, right to Jesus. She doesn't stew about it. She's not at all shy. She's willing to confront him, not in a disrespectful way, but in a very straightforward way, to ask him why he's doing what he's doing or how. And so I think we can kind of see a difference in personality between Mary and Martha, where Mary is a little bit quieter. She's observing. And again, a lot of this is speculation because these are really limited, but based on these two interactions that we see, it seems consistent that Mary's like really an observer. She's watching, she's listening. She's maybe a little bit softer, and maybe she is mad in this case, but she's going to wait and see what Jesus says about it. Whereas Martha's mad and she's going to tell Jesus right away.
I think that's really good. Because what I was going to say is, what's interesting is it's almost like they swapped roles, right? In the first story with them, Mary is attending to Jesus and Martha's attending to the duties. In this story, it's like Mary's attending to the duties, perhaps, if what Anne says is right. And I think that's probably true. While Martha is attending to Jesus, but you're pointing out they may not have swapped roles. They're just reflecting the same personalities they did in the earlier story, where Martha had an issue and she brought it to Jesus directly. And she's doing that now. All good thoughts. It's just fascinating to me.
Not only
this is happening. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, not only did Martha have an issue that she brought to Jesus there, and she has an issue here, it's also like Martha gets stuff done. So in the first story, that was by doing stuff in the house. And in this story, it's by coming to Jesus and being like, why didn't you do anything? And what are you going to do about it now?
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Lord, Martha said to Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And it is hard to tell. Is she angry? Is she grumpy? Is she confused? Maybe all of the above. Because she also caveats this. It's not just an accusation. Maybe it's not an accusation at all. And maybe it is. Regardless of whether it is, it's definitely a faith statement. It's an interesting statement to say. If you'd been here, you would not have died. With most people, that would be unfair, right? I mean, unless there's something specifically you're bringing the medicine or you're the doctor, it's really, it's a lot to say to somebody, you weren't here and that's why he died. But she believes that. If you'd been here, he would not have died. But then she goes on and says, but I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. Now, I don't know what she means by this, because it doesn't, at first it might seem like she's asking him to raise Lazarus from the dead, but the next sentence she's going to speak doesn't seem to indicate that's what she's thinking will happen. So I'm not sure exactly, I don't actually know exactly where she is, except she could be conflicted. Maybe she is wanting him to bring Lazarus back from the dead, but not really believing that he's going to do that, because that's a big ask. So I think more than anything, what we can see is there's conflict and there's confusion and there's a lot of emotions. But she comes to Jesus, she brings this forward, she says in one sense with faith, whether also with anger or whatever, there is this faith that says, if you'd been here, he wouldn't have died. And then number two, I even know even now, God will give you whatever you ask. And Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Here's, again, it's kind of like when Jesus said to them, he's asleep and he meant he's dead. Jesus is actually speaking really clearly right now, but it's such a weird thing to say that her assumption, and remember, if she's received the message from Jesus already that this will not end in death, if she chose, as I think most of us would after he's already dead, to read that as a metaphorical or a long-term comfort, you know, I might say that to somebody, you know, this loved one's death is not the end. I might say that to someone and they would understand me to be speaking about long time future, not tomorrow, not now, not 5 minutes from now. If she's already heard his message and already reconciled that way, then when he says this to her, your brother will rise again, it makes perfect sense that she says, Martha answered, I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. It's unclear to me if she's still wanting him to say more, if she has hope for more, but she's just kind of holding it at bay, or if she's just completely doesn't, if she's about to be completely surprised. I don't know. That one phrase in there where she says, God will give you whatever you ask, makes me think there's a part of her that is actually hoping that Jesus is going to do the impossible. I'm not sure. I don't know. What do you guys think about that conversation so far?
I think she could be kind of the, I believe, help me in my unbelief when he comes in and the man says, I do believe, but then you back up and you're like, help me believe, you know, like if you had been here, he wouldn't have died. I mean, she clearly has faith that Jesus would have healed him before he died.
Yeah, for sure.
So, and then she's saying, you may, you know, and then she's like, do I have this faith? Do I have enough faith to believe that you can go one step further and raise him for the dead? And I think I do, but help me believe.
Well, and maybe it's, again, he said things that can reasonably be read about as talking about the last day. So maybe it's not even fair to talk about it as not having enough faith. Maybe what it is it's just doing what we all do. Maybe it's the faith to accept that that may not be what he means. Maybe she has hope and wants to believe that he's going to raise Lazarus from the dead. But maybe she also has faith to accept, okay, he's going to come back at the end. That's what we all have to accept at death, right? Most of us don't expect our loved ones are going to come back within a couple hours of Jesus arriving, so to speak. You know, so but I think you're right, Anne. I think there's a lot of conflict. And I do think there's some hope and some faith here. I think there's a lot of faith here, but I think there's some hope and some confusion and some question. I do feel like there's an undercurrent of maybe she has enough imagination to see Jesus bringing Lazarus back from the dead, but she also has enough faith to say, if that's not what's happening, I accept that it will happen at the end. That it kind of feels that way to me, that she doesn't want to presume, but she has some hope. And I think there's a great deal of faith in that. I think there's a lot of seed of faith here, at least a mustard seed size. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though they die. And whoever lives by believing me will never die. Do you believe this? Now, again, he hasn't said anything that can't be understood as the resurrection to come. He could be more clear if he wanted to. He could go from Lazarus is asleep to Lazarus is dead. He could go from, yes, he will ultimately come back to, he's coming back now. But it is as if he's just trying to see where she's at first. And so he asks her this question, you know, do you believe that I'm the resurrection? Do you believe in this future resurrection you're talking about? I know this is a hard question right now while you're grieving, but do you believe that? And she says, "Yes, Lord," she replied, "I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world." It's fascinating to me that her answer to his question, which is kind of a general theological question, becomes a very personal declaration of faith. One akin to the one that Jesus said of Peter, "You are my rock," or I'm going to call you rock because this is the foundation. This is a declaration of belief as strong as anybody has made to Jesus. And she makes it here at this moment of great grief, at this moment when she could be pushing away and saying, "Well, I don't know, you weren't here. You should have been here, but you weren't." And she ultimately is saying, "No, I believe it. You are the Messiah. You are the Son of God. You have come into the world. And because of that, we will ultimately all live." Maybe she's saying more. Maybe she's saying you could bring him back to life right now if you want. I don't know. After she had said this, she went, but she didn't wait. She's not like, "So what are you going to do?" She's like, "No, I believe you are." And it says, after she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. "The teacher is here," she said, "and is asking for you." I'm going to assume she's not manipulating or lying or trying to make Mary feel better and that Jesus did ask for Mary. Doesn't tell us that in this story, but I assume that's actually what happened. But she goes back, she tells Mary, "He's asking for you." It says, when Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. And again, why does she go quickly now? Because she's angry? Or is it because she was just sad and if she hears the teacher's asking for her, even that gives her hope? Oh, he does care. Maybe she thought he didn't care. She's like, Jesus didn't even care enough to come back. You know, he sent this trite message about not ending in death after he's already dead, you know, but now he's asking for her. Maybe there is something about that moves her heart because she loves Jesus. We know that. Or maybe it's like Anne said, she was just really busy. And now Martha's like, "Hey, he's asking for it. You should go." And she's like, "Okay, I'll go."
Really quickly, the interaction with Martha also kind of makes me think of in Habakkuk when he lays out all his questions for God. And then he says, "Now I'm going to watch and wait and see how he answers my complaint." It's like he has questions. He's both trusting God and believing that God has answers, but he's not just sort of closing his eyes or like, "Okay, whatever you say goes." Like he's willing to bring that and press into looking for answers.
He's doing that waiting on the Lord. He's actually going to look for that and know that it's coming. I like that. That's really good. Now, Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house comforting her noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Now, this is 100% unfair. So I'm just going to say it, and then you can all tell me why I'm all wet, because I am. These are the exact same words Martha spoke. I don't know if it's because she's at his feet and she's weeping. I don't know why it is. They sound different to me. When Martha says them, they sound like faith. When Mary says them, they sound like a complaint. And again, I don't know if there's anything in the story that lends to that or if that's just me, because they are exactly the same words. So does anybody-
It's just you.
It's just me. Okay. That's what I was
going to say. I think Mary gets a bad rap.
Oh, I don't think she does. I really do.
Oh, that's so funny. I think Martha had Martha.
Yeah, I don't know.
Personality. I think Martha gets a bad rap for that other story, and then people have more grace for Mary coming into the story. So perhaps. I am a Martha.
I just think like the Martha had faith and Mary didn't kind of thing. I'm just bouncing off of. I don't know. I think it's to me the whole she. You don't hear about Martha crying and holding on to Jesus. And what I feel is not complaining. To me, when Mary throws herself at Jesus's feet, crying that with the same faith, it's the sorrow. She's pouring herself out at his feet.
Well, I think that makes perfect sense. I think that's entirely possible. I will say, I don't give Mary bad rap. So in other words, what I mean is the only reason I think of that here is because of the flop. In other words, I think most people, when they read the Mary Martha story, they see Mary sitting at Jesus' feet and they tend to think of her as the one with devotion and faith. And when they read later that Mary is the one who pours water on his feet and cries at his feet, they see her as the one of faith. So the only reason I'm even thinking about the other direction here is because it would be different. I don't think most people think of her as lacking faith. So if I sound like I'm picking on her too much, that's just me at this story right now. And I think you're right.
Lori and I agree with you as far as in that other story. And I was even about when you guys were talking about it, and I was just a fly on the wall because I wasn't able to chime in. I'm in your camp. I think Martha gets a really bad rap in that other.
Yeah. And what I see here too is that however they come to Jesus, he responds to them in the way that they approached him. So I think they're both grieving, but Martha approaches him intellectually and Mary approaches him emotionally. And he responds to Martha intellectually and he's emotionally moved by Mary. And so I don't think that means that Martha's like not grieving. I think that's just the way she's processing it. And so I think it just shows that he meets them like exactly where they are specifically.
Yeah. I think that's a solid point. That's a solid takeaway. I don't think you even have to speculate on that at all. I think that's exactly right. Jesus responds to them as they come to him. I think that's good.
And that's actually, to elaborate a little bit more, I was actually just thinking about it right now, that I have one, or actually, I have two very emotional children, and then I have one very logical one. And fortunately, the children as of yet haven't had to deal with the death of a loved one. But I could imagine that that my two emotional children would have a very different reaction than my logical child. Even though all three of them, if it was somebody that they're close to, all three of them will be grieving. But my logical child would process it differently than my highly emotional other two children.
Yeah. Well, and I think we see that here even as he progresses, because his words to her, so Martha came and he does have this conversation with her. With Mary, he bypasses the conversation. She comes, she says this thing to him in her grief, and he doesn't even respond to that. He doesn't respond to what she said the way he responded to what Martha said. He doesn't sort of, you know, say, I am the resurrection. He doesn't give her any of that. He responds simply by saying, let me come mourn with you. Where is he? Let me come do what all people who mourn, who are seeing you today do. So I think even that indicates he's coming to them as they come to him. So Martha comes, she says the exact same words, but Jesus is able to tell that she actually is interested in a little bit of theological hope. She needs something to pin her hope on, to do with her grief. Mary comes, she's not looking for a theological hope. She's looking for Jesus, her friend who wasn't there. And so Jesus, her friend who wasn't there, is going to be there. And so I think that is actually, and in that sense, it's very similar to the stories and personalities we saw before from them. And I don't think, by the way, for the record, I don't think either story is about reproving either person. I don't think Jesus or the scripture writers intended the early Mary Martha story to be about how bad Mary was, or this story to be about how bad Martha or Mary are. I actually don't think that's the point of either story. So I agree with you guys here. And you have persuaded me. I don't think Mary's angry. I think she's sad. Says when Jesus saw her weeping, the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? He asked. Again, he just immediately goes to, where is he? You know, we're not gonna have this theological discussion to have with Martha, because that's not where what you need. Where have you laid him? He said, come and see, Lord. They replied. Jesus wept. Of course, this is a very famous verse. It's the shortest verse in the Bible, so that's a good trivia answer. Anytime there's Bible trivia, which isn't that often, but it's a good trivia question and answer. But it's also because it's so short, because it says everything it needs to say. You know, there's a lot of, the more you think about it, the more profound that statement is, because Jesus knows he is literally minutes away from bringing Lazarus back to life. So he's not weeping for Lazarus. The one person in this whole story who is unaffected the most by the fact that Jesus didn't come back is Lazarus. He's dead. He's not, none of this is time passing for him. I mean, we don't know what happens. I don't know. I don't want to get into that, because I don't know what happens during the time Lazarus is dead. Is his spirit somewhere, or is, I don't know. But in a sense, he's the least, like, he's not relevant in this story for now until he gets raised. He doesn't feel anything. Jesus isn't weeping for him. Jesus knows that Lazarus is about to come back to life. He's not even weeping long-term for where they're going to be. He could be like, come on, guys, it's going to be okay. Buck up. We're fine. But the fact that he takes the time to weep, the fact that he takes the time, that he's moved in spirit by their sorrow, it's not even like a conscious thing. It's just his response. is because he feels that he's just empathetic. He just cares about them. He just loves them so much that they're weeping, so he's weeping, even though he knows it's going to be better. And I think that's super encouraging, because that's the God that we serve, that when we're weeping and we're sad, he knows things are going to be okay tomorrow. So often I feel really bummed out about something, and then a day later, it's all better, and I feel silly. I'm like, why was I so grumpy, or why was I so sad, or why was I so frustrated? That turned out not to be a big deal at all. In fact, it was really good. But it's really important for me to recognize that at that moment, God wasn't just rolling his eyes at me, but he was able to say, I know you feel this way. It's a bummer you feel this way. And to grieve with me, even though he knew it would be better in 24 hours. And I think that's, to me, that's a hugely profound message about Jesus, that he can grieve with us, even knowing things are going to be better very soon. I really like that. So come and see, Lord.
It's such a good model for how we should be with people who are close to us that are grieving, not to rush past that point of their grief. And that's when people feel like you're giving them trite or easy answers, is I think when you don't stop and weep with them before you remind them of this.
Of course. Yep. So Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, see how he loved him. Some of them are like, oh, he really did love him. Which again, they're kind of missing it. He's not weeping for Lazarus, but see how he loved him. But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? And you know what? It's a good question. And it's the question we often have, right? And what, you know, there's no way to explain the miracles God does and the miracles God doesn't do. And I think it's true. You know, C.S. Lewis points out we should be amazed anytime he does a miracle. But it is always a question, you know, why choose that and not this? Why save this person, you know, from death and not this one? And even as Jesus walked to the earth, we know he didn't heal everybody. He didn't heal every disease, and he didn't raise a lot of people back to life. But that's the question that comes when you're grieving. And that's what they're saying. They're saying, look, we know he opened the eyes of the blind man. Couldn't he have kept this man from dying? Mary and Martha both said it. If you'd been here, he wouldn't have died. Jesus, once more, deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Take away the stone, he said. But Lord, said Martha, the sister of the dead man, practical, logical Martha, by this time there's a bad odor, for he has been there for 4 days. I think she thinks he just wants to see him. And she's like, not a great idea. You know, maybe you don't realize how long it's been. Then Jesus said, did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God? So here, again, to Martha, who's kind of open to it, he's like, I got something important's going to happen. Trust me. Trust me. So they took away the stone. There's a lot between those two sentences, by the way. Did I not tell you that if you believe, you'll see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. Who took away the stone? Why did they take away the stone? What convinced them? Was it Mary, who was just like, you know what? He's my brother. If I say, take away the stone, take away the stone. Because this doesn't happen quickly. This is a lot of work to remove the stone in front of a cave. It takes a few people, and it takes a fair amount of effort and time. So it's just, again, said very casually here, but there's a lot at stake here. And if Jesus isn't about to do something amazing, again, it all looks kind of cruel and meaningless. It's like, why are you putting everybody through this? Why all this stuff? It's like the message you sent saying it won't end in death after he died. It feels meaningless and cruel, but of course it's not, because of what it does lead to. So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe you sent me. This is what made me feel okay about horizontal prayers. Sometimes we pray things in ways to help. Even when you're praying for people in a prayer circle, sometimes you pray things because you want the other person to hear them. You want them to be encouraged by what you're praying. And I used to think that was kind of cheap and cowardly, but I actually think Jesus did it, so it must be okay. But in this case, it's also in line with what this whole thing has been about. All of this from the very beginning has been that so that people would see. They would have a chance to see the incredible glory and power of God and receive an incredible joy that is just going to be beyond what they've seen. The apostles, I'm glad that I wasn't there so you could see what you're about to see. Mary and Martha, because he loves them, he delayed. There's all these, and now his prayer is the same thing. I'm doing this. I care. I cried. I wept. I grieved. That's all me. That's all real. But all of this I'm doing for their benefit, all of it. And I'm not just doing it for me. I'm not doing it at all for me, in fact. I'm doing it for their benefit. And so even in his prayer, it's for their benefit. When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. This has got to be very spooky. At first I thought it was a little comical, and then I realized, nope, it's not comical at all, because this is a dead man and this is very spooky. He just walked out and he's still wrapped up in his cloths. I mean, he's a mummy. He just walked out of the tomb. Jesus yells loudly, and here comes this dead guy walking out of the tomb, presumably whole, not just resurrected, but also 4 days backwards in time. I think there's no indication of death and decay. They were worried he was going to smell. In fact, he's better than when he died, is my guess. He comes out, his feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. And Jesus said to them, take off the grave clothes and let him go. So matter of fact, he's like, oh, just, you know, let the guy go. Poor guy's all wrapped up in grave clothes. He can't see anything. His face is covered. And it doesn't tell us the rest of this story, but given the human emotion that Jesus has shown, given the way that the human emotion that everybody has shown, you can only imagine the party that takes place after this, the celebration, the amazement, the awe, the praise, the worship, the prayers, the hugs all around. You know, I imagine Jesus is one of the, you know, he probably, the only reason he wasn't the first one to hug Lazarus is because he probably wanted to let Martha and Mary get in there first. You know, it's just, you can just kind of envision what an incredible day. You know, that this is just going to, they have all this, probably this morning food. Now it turns into a feast. This is impossible to hide, by the way. Some of the miracles Jesus does, he's like, don't tell anyone. This is big. People have come from Jerusalem. This is going to catch fire quickly. Everybody's going to know. And indeed, the scripture skips. It doesn't tell us what happens for them. It doesn't tell us about their celebration. It doesn't tell us about all the questions and all the answers and Jesus hanging out with them and all the things he must have said about being the resurrection. It doesn't tell us any of that. It skips to the results. It skips to the polarizing effect that this has. And this is what it says. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. And then the chief priests and Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. Again, it's possible it means that many believed and some went to the Pharisees to try to persuade them how good it was, and the Pharisees took it badly. I don't think so, though. I think we're supposed to see a contrast in response for even those who were there. Some believed in Jesus and some went and tattled on Jesus to the Pharisees and framed it in such a way that it just inflamed the priests and the Pharisees more. And they called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. And this meeting of the Sanhedrin, this is it. This is the precursor. This is the, we're going to go from here to a bunch of stories in Luke and Matthew, which happened in a very short period of time, but they take a few chapters. So it's easy to forget, but this is the meeting that's leading to the meeting that's going to be his actual trial. This is it. This is when they're deciding. This is kind of the grand jury. This is kind of the indictment. Yes, we think we should arrest him. Absolutely, for sure. No more hesitation. All right. Let's do this quickly. I'll do it quickly. Let's see. What are we accomplishing? They asked the Sanhedrin. Here is this man proclaiming many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. This is the concern. This is what the rationale that the Sanhedrin, the Pharisees, and I think it's real. This is what the Pharisees and the high priests are concerned about, that Jesus is persuading enough people that he's real. They don't really think he is, but he's persuading enough people that he's real that he's going to lead a revolution. And if he leads a revolution, he's going to stir up the Romans, and the Romans are going to take away all the privileges that the Jews have. What do those privileges include? Worship, yes. But they also include things that specifically benefit the Pharisees and the priests. They're going to take away their compensation. They're going to take away the money that they make as high priests. Because right now, the priest is an official, the Romans count it as an official position, and they actually funnel taxes to the high priest. The Pharisees have this power, this status, this prestige. If the Jews revolt because of what Jesus is doing, then that's all going to go away. The Romans are going to come, that's their fear anyway. The Romans are going to come down on them. The high priest will be, you know, not compensated or well-liked. The Pharisees will lose their status with the Romans in particular. They kind of lose this position of political power. So they're worried about that. They don't want Jesus to cause trouble and to stir up trouble. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. So what's happening is they're having an argument about it, even though they're like, there's this problem. Caiaphas is much stronger. He comes out and says, it's better for Jesus to die than for the whole nation to perish because Rome comes down on us. Now, I'm going to get into this a lot more later, so this is why I can do this very quickly. Turns out there's increasing evidence. It's fascinating, actually. There's increasing evidence that Caiaphas is not just your run-of-the-mill corrupt priest. There's evidence the priesthood in Jesus' time is particularly bad. And the more evidence we find, we found more ossuaries. Remember, ossuaries are like stones that talk about famous people and their tombs. We found more ossuaries about Caiaphas in the last couple decades than we had before. And one of the things we know is becoming increasingly clear. Caiaphas was kind of the godfather of an extremely corrupt priesthood. They shouldn't have been priests. They probably weren't Levites. Caiaphas himself is actually the son-in-law of the previous high priest named Annas. Annas, for some reason, abdicated his high priesthood and gave it to Caiaphas, and yet Annas hangs out and is constantly talking with Caiaphas. So it becomes there's sort of this picture of Annas pulling all the strings, and his son-in-law is kind of doing what he wants, but both of them, it really is like a godfather thing. Killing Jesus is not, except that we know who Jesus is, killing Jesus to Caiaphas is not even the worst thing he's done. He kills people. That's what he does. There's increasing evidence he is just a bad guy using the priesthood for power, and there's very little room for sympathy for him as any kind of actual guy who cares about the Jewish religion or about priesthood or anything. It's fascinating what's kind of unfolding about him. Nonetheless, it explains his reaction here. He's looking for a reason to hold on to his power, and he's like, we should just kill Jesus. That'll take care of the problem. He did not say this on his own, but John goes on and says, God's still in control. Get this. He did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for the nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. So John's like, Caiaphas thought he was just saying something to get his way, but he doesn't realize God was using the high priest position to speak through Caiaphas's mouth to let people know that Jesus was indeed going to die for the nation, which is fascinating. So from that day on, it says, they plotted to take his life. Therefore, Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the people of Judea. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the wilderness where he stayed with his disciples. So now he begins to hunker down. Now the night is coming. Now the daylight's starting to run out. So he's starting to hide out a little bit. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, many went up from the country to Jerusalem for their ceremonial cleansing before the Passover. They kept looking for Jesus. And as they stood in the temple courts, they asked one another, what do you think? Isn't he coming to the festival at all? You can imagine the anticipation. The last couple festivals he's come to, he's said big things about being the Messiah. It's kind of been amazing. He's done some big miracles. Now they've heard that he's just brought someone back from the dead. It's all the news. It's all the rave. But they also know that people want to kill him because that's also pretty public now. And so they're like, it's the big news. Everybody's wondering. The festival's here. Is Jesus going to be here? Is he coming? But the chief priests and Pharisees had given orders that anyone who found out where Jesus was should report it so they might arrest him. And might means could and would. And that's where we are. We're going to pick up next week with a bunch of stories where it kind of feels like a different tone. It's not. It's actually during the same time, but they're Luke and Matthew. And Luke and Matthew haven't sort of been as clear as John about what's happening in the background here with the Pharisees. But it is the right time frame. So we're going to read about things Jesus is doing, and you'll understand some of the things he does and says and why he kind of keeps them quiet, why he kind of tries to tell people not to talk, why he's kind of not going to Jerusalem. And yet what we discover as we read through the Luke and Matthew passages is he is actually working his way back to Jerusalem. He's just doing it slowly. And he is going to show up for the festival, but he's going to show up later than people expected him to. And so we'll kind of see all that come together. But that's where we are. This is like exciting moment in the story and the history and the movie. They've just said, yes, we're going to kill him. Yes, we need to arrest him. And everybody's standing around at the festival saying, is Jesus coming? Does anyone know if he's coming? Is he coming? So that's where we are. Any comments or questions or thoughts before we hang up for the day?
Well, I just thought it was weird that he said, you know nothing at all. When they actually just said what he said.
Where?
So in 48, it says, if we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in Caiaphas. Him. And you know, all this. Yeah. And then Caiaphas says, you know, nothing at all. But they basically just said what he, right?
I think they're arguing about it. So you're right. The thing we just read was like, well, it's going to be a problem, but nobody was going so far as to saying we should kill him. And so I think they're arguing about what do we do with him. And that's why Caiaphas is like, you guys are stupid. Listen to me. We should kill him. It's okay to kill him. I think it's probably argument from better, more well-meaning people who are like, is it really okay to kill Jesus? That just seems kind of extreme. And I think that's why he's like, yeah, you don't know anything. You're stupid. But you're right. It's implied. It's not explicit, but it is the way to explain why he says that. Go ahead, Jeff.
I just always like to point this out with Lazarus. So when Jesus was crucified, they shoved a spear into his side and blood and water came out. That confirms he's dead. The other thing is the practice of awake is because there are certain chemicals that can basically put you in a coma-like state for about 3 days. So Lazarus being in the grave for 4 days means he was dead, you know, beyond even like modern, you know, understanding.
Gotcha. Cool. Good. That's good.
Thank you for joining us. The Journey is a ministry of Discipleship Matters, which is an extension of Focus Church and is created by David McGill for the purpose of helping equip pastors to build discipleship communities in their own churches. If you'd like to learn more about the books and conferences and coaching offered by David, you can check out his website, davidmcgill.com.